Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 140,000 people died when America dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, August 6th, 1945. Seventy thousand more people died in Nagasaki 3 days later when America bombed that city. Oscar-winning filmmaker Stephen Okazaki talked to hundreds of survivors and tells their story in his new film, White Light, Black Rain. This hour, On Point, Stephen Okazaki on the bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki 62 years ago. Joining me now from Chicago is Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Stephen Okazaki. His past films include Days of Waiting, The Life and Art of Estelle Ishigo, Black Tar Heroin, The Dark End of the Street, and The Mushroom Cloud. His new film is White Light, Black Rain, The Destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It will begin airing on HBO next week. Stephen, welcome to you. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
What's drawn you to this subject, Stephen?
Well, it's a subject that I've been drawn to and have run away from, actually, since 1980 when I was a young filmmaker and accidentally met a group of survivors in San Francisco. There are about 1,000 Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors in the United States. Hiroshima had the highest amount of immigration to the United States before the war, and so many people have, Japanese Americans here have roots in Hiroshima, and many of them, many Japanese women also married GIs and came back. So they're in most of the big cities around the country, there are survivors, and it's something I came upon by accident. I met I was actually helping my sister do a school report and helped her do some research and discovered that there was a group of survivors that were meeting in San Francisco once a month to talk about common health problems. And I did all this research for my sister, and then I called her up and I said, let's go to this meeting. And she said, oh, I forgot to tell you, I dropped that class. But I went to the meeting on my own and was immediately kind of grabbed that with the idea of doing the film, and that people are really afraid of the subject. I mean, for good reason. It's, you know, afraid of the horrific stories and images. But I was in this room and I thought, well, there are a bunch of nice 50, 60-year-old ladies, and this would be a powerful way to tell the story through them and a less threatening way to do it.
You say people are afraid to hear about this in some ways. How do you tell a story? How do you do that, that many people really don't want to hear?
Well, I think that, you try to make a compelling, entertaining film, really. I think so many of the films on the subject have been basically message films, mm-hmm. good messages, perhaps, mm-hmm. but sort of hit you over the head, you know. And this, what we try to do with this film is establish a certain trust with the audience. And even at the beginning, the film is not heavy-handed. It's not your documentary where, you know, it's 60 years ago. You get a sense of the life of the people, life in Japan now. And one thing, you know, I think that one thing I think the film does is sort of the, we found survivors who with really clear, sharp memories, and the one thing that many of them said before they started the interview was, you know, I remember this like yesterday. Mm-hmm. And I think when you see the film, you feel that these are memories that they mm-hmm. have not been able to escape, that are as sharp and clear in their minds as if it happened yesterday.
In fact, you met hundreds of survivors and you interviewed more than 100 before you chose the 14 people that are in the film. What was it about their particular stories, beyond the fact that they remember it as if it were yesterday? What was it about what they experienced that moved you?
Well, I think, you know, I try with the interviews to have the first really, to not do too much pre-interviewing, and so that my experience of first talking to them is filmed. And so sometimes it's just a sense. I was in a, occasionally, I don't, you know, to not be crass, we sort of did casting calls. You know, we put the word out. If anyone was interested in being in this documentary, they should come to this community meeting. And so there was an outpouring of people who really were eager to tell their stories. And
many of them had never spoken publicly before.
I think, yeah, many haven't spoken before. And I think, you know, clearly there was a feeling that if we don't, you know, tell our story now, you know, 10 years from now, our, you know, the memory won't be as clear, and or we won't be around. Many of the people came out of the hospital to be in the film. Mm-hmm. One of the women, we had to take breaks for her to take a morphine shot and a rest in between interview sessions. So, but with many people, there was just a sense that they had this story that they were holding back. And in one case, I had a large group of people, and they were, and all of them were talking animatedly. And there was one man who hadn't spoken at all, and I just said, "Could you just tell me, you know, a little bit about yourself?" And he just said, "I had 6 brothers and 2 sisters," and then he started to weep and walk and got up and left the room. Mm-hmm. And so I followed him, and it actually took a couple days, but I convinced him to try to tell his story in the film, although I didn't know the story until we filmed him.
Hmm. There are so many incredible stories. You know, they describe the hurricane force winds, this enveloping fire. Many of these survivors that you speak with, they were left disfigured. They lost entire families. They developed lifelong illnesses from radiation poisoning. I mean, the stories just go on and on.
Well, it's a, you know, it's a remarkable thing. And, you know, it's one thing you learn that, you know, surviving is not just about, you know, surviving physically, but it's really about surviving spiritually and, you know, emotionally. That, I mean, there are survivors who, you know, I've met who aren't in the film, who I think were destroyed by what they experienced, could not really, haven't been able to really lead normal lives. They've been consumed by, you know, bitterness or guilt. So, you know, one thing I like to remind people that this is not the whole story. This is the story of the survivors. And it's a, you know, particular, it's a, you know, we've lost the stories of people who were in their 30s, people who were mothers and fathers. The most of the people in the film, the people right now who can tell the story are teenagers. That, well, they're, I say the average age of the people in the film is about 11 to 13. And so this is a, you know, a young person's remembrance of what happened. Mm-hmm. We've, you know, I think the people that were younger at the time who are, just don't have the sharp memories, mm-hmm. and their memories have been mixed with other people's memories, even things they've read or seen in movies. Mm-hmm. And so what we try to do is, you know, really, it's the one thing, the one mandate for the interviews is that people had really sharp sharp memories, because we wanted both the urgency and we wanted to, you know, tell the story. I mean, there was a feeling that this really perhaps was the last chance to capture these stories on film. And so we really tried to find the most compelling stories. Although I have to say, sometimes the stories were just too compelling. They were so, you know, it was, I mean, normally in a documentary, you're, you know, you really savor those dramatic moments, but we had such a wealth of them. It was, in this case, we, you know, sometimes search for a lighter moment as opposed, because there was so much drama and tragedy.
Hmm. I want to play a clip from White Light, Black Rain. Here is footage from the 1942 Time Incorporated documentary, The Enemy Japan. And this is U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Joseph Grew.
Japanese are not easy to know. I've lived among them for 10 years. And I can testify that they are as different from ourselves as any people on this planet. The real difference is in their minds. You cannot measure Japanese sense of logic by any Western yardstick. Their weapons are modern. Their thinking is 2,000 years out of date.
What did you want Americans to understand about this period, Stephen?
Well, I think, one thing we tried to do from the in terms of telling the survivor's story is connect the story to World War II. I think many times the story is told as if it starts on August 6th, and, you know, clearly, and I think when the story is told in Japan, often the World War II is separated from the rest of from the events in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. With this clip, though, I think, you know, it was kind of startling in that you could just replace the word Japanese with Islamic fundamentalists, and it's the exact same rhetoric that we hear today. I mean, it's how you create your enemy is you make them seem as foreign as possible. His description of the Japanese is. He goes on to say, you know, they don't care about life on earth because their reward is in heaven, and which leads them, you know, which and makes them fanatics. You know, that probably is a description of several religions, including Christianity. Mm-hmm. But somehow it sounds frightening and foreign, and that's how we create an enemy, and that's how we make it okay to kill them.
Stephen, I want to put this period of time and this period of your film into context by playing a clip from White Light, Black Rain. This is President Harry Truman, August 13th, 1945, speaking to the nation.
I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by the Secretary of State on August 11th. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan.
And the celebrations that followed.
Through the early evening, Tuesday, August 14th, the fateful news is flashed. In New York City, as throughout a rejoicing nation and world, vast throngs of grateful, happy people celebrate the end of fighting, the dawn of peace. 2 million New Yorkers jam Times Square. It's official. It's all over. It's total victory.
Stephen, is it your sense that people generally have made up their minds about whether the bombing at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was right or wrong, but generally speaking, they've forgotten about the survivors, about what happened on the ground? And can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure. Well, I think that it's not so much people have forgotten what happened to the survivors, but people don't know and they haven't been given that information. I mean, one of the motivations for doing the film for me was that every time you say the words Hiroshima and Nagasaki, people jump into their argument as to why it was justified or why it was not, why it was right or why it was wrong. And those sides are so far away, and I think very few people actually know what happened there. And we just wanted to say, let's just for a moment, let's hit the pause button and hear the stories of the people that were there on the ground. And the people who were in the airplanes above, there are four Americans who are also in the film, the two of the people on the Enola Gay and two scientists that were in an observer plane. Mm-hmm. But, my feeling is people, we've had several screenings where people have wanted to give their theories and opinions and speculation based on hindsight. And, I don't disagree or agree with any of them, but I think that it's a way of avoiding to me hearing the stories, talking about radiation. I mean, some people said, well, it was just another bomb, just bigger than the others. But, you know, the other bombs, didn't have people dying of cancer and still dying of cancer 60 years later. Mm-hmm. Other bombs didn't cause women to be infertile, to have deformed children. It wasn't just a bomb. And it's something, one thing I think we've been it's been 62 years since the bombing, and people have been sort of wrapped up in the bad feelings of World War II for so long. But I think since 9/11, I think the way people respond to the film is very different, and now they're thinking about how it reflects on our future and what it means in terms of now. I mean, it's clearly a really dangerous time we're in, and now I think in people's minds there's the possibility of, you know, a completely unexpected random use of a nuclear weapon, which is absolutely frightening. And now suddenly, especially since 9/11, seems like something that can happen. Mm.
I want to hear from the survivors directly from your film. This is Sakui Shirahira. She was 10 years old in the summer of 1945. And here she talks about what happened after the bomb fell.
It was difficult to identify the bodies. As we searched, we cried, "Mommy!" I saw two burnt bodies not too far away. I saw that one of the bodies had holes where the eyes should be and one gold tooth. My mother had one gold tooth, so I knew it was her. "Hurry, I found her," I yelled to my sister. My sister said, "I'm too scared." I said, "Come here now." So my sister ran over. Together, we looked at the body. We reached out and said, "Mommy." Before our eyes, it crumbled into ashes. This happened 60 years ago, but I'll never forget. "Mommy."
And when Sakui could not help her mother, she tried to help her sister.
My sister stopped talking. I told her, "Hang on. Life is worth living." But she missed our mother and fell deeper into despair. She jumped in front of a train going at full speed. I just couldn't go on. So I went to the train tracks and stood where my sister had stood. I heard the whistle and waited as the train rushed toward me. But I became afraid and jumped aside. I realized there are two kinds of courage: the courage to live and the courage to die. My sister had the courage to die. Me? I chose the courage to live. Even if I'm alone, I still want to live.
You know, what struck me, Stephen, as I watched your film, is that these survivors were really ostracized. You know, nobody wanted to be associated with the victims after the bombings. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why that happened?
Well, it was a difficult question. I asked it many times and never fully understood it myself, but the people that were not badly hurt, who did not lose their homes in the blast, shunned the people who were badly hurt, and they had absolutely miserable lives, not just for a few years, for some of them for 10, 20 years. And the Japanese, the Americans dropped the bomb, but the Japanese and the Japanese government continued the misery for the survivors for many years. There was no medical care for them. People were examined but not given care by the team of Japanese and American doctors, and women who were infertile were told that it was their fault. And people who had cancers, the incidence in cancer took 10 and 15 years to peak and still haunts survivors. But the survivors were also told, well, you know, people get cancer, even though the cancer rates among survivors were extraordinarily high. It was a continuing tragedy for the survivors,
and yet,
I think many more people died who didn't need to.
And yet the survivors in this film do not seem to hold any anger, which seemed remarkable to me.
Well, I think for, a Western audience, it almost seems strange that they're fairly calm and there doesn't seem to be real bitterness in the way they speak or anger. But I, in doing the film and sitting with so many of them and hearing their stories, you realize that, well, you can't, watch their family die, when someone's lost their entire family, become an orphan, there's still, you cannot hold the anger and bitterness inside of you without it destroying you. And I think many people were destroyed. Many people did commit suicide, but these are the people that survived. And to me, the film is very difficult, but the powerful moments for me is like in the last clip where Mrs. Shimo Hiro talks about, having the courage to live. And I think the other profound statement in the film was there's a woman who lost her brother and sister who blames herself, and she just says, I think about my brother and how he never got to taste chocolate. And it's just, that appreciation of life. And I think that one thing the survivors have in the film is this enhanced, absolute joy to be alive and to savor those little things.
Stephen, hold on for just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining me now from Boulder Junction, Colorado, is Richard Cohn. He's professor of military history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's nice to have you with us, Richard. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jane.
Would you take us back in time, please, and help us understand what's going on in the world at the time that led up to America's bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
That time was really the end point of the world's worst war in modern history. Some 60 million people, we think, perhaps died, and untold millions displaced. The first war in three centuries where civilian populations were drawn in huge numbers as part of the combat, and essentially through air power, sometimes targeted by the combatant countries. The Pacific War was particularly, though not uniquely, ferocious. It was pervaded by racist hatred on both sides, but that was rooted in generations past.
Mm-hmm.
And the casualties were increasing in the Pacific War as the U.S. drew closer, U.S. forces drew closer to Japan. I think we have to remember that the U.S. had embraced strategic bombing from the start of the war. Other powers had, too, and had carried it out in Europe and was using it against Japan.
And so
conventional bombing.
And so with that as a backdrop, then, what were President Harry Truman's options? What was going on in his mind at that time?
In his mind, he was trying to end the war in the Pacific. By July, of course, the Allies were meeting at Potsdam. In his mind, he wanted to end the war as quickly and as effectively as possible with the minimum number of casualties on the American side, particularly the Allied side. And he was informed at Potsdam that the atomic bomb had been tested and worked. He had not known about it until he became president in April of that year. And so from his perspective, as I read the record, the effort was, how do we end this war with unconditional surrender, which was the American goal, as quickly as possible? And in fact, at Potsdam, he was reassured by Joseph Stalin that the Soviet Union would come into the war and help because, mm-hmm. of course, it had grown more ferocious as, mm-hmm. as the U.S. got closer.
We're hearing about the devastation from the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. How did they compare to other types of attacks? Is there a comparison?
Well, there is a comparison. It's difficult. In terms of the numbers killed, there were, in fact, worse bombings, the Tokyo bombing of March 9-10, in which the U.S. had first used low-level incendiaries. But I think the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was particularly horrifying because of the lack of warning, the enormous destruction wreaked instantaneously, and these horrifying lasting medical suffering of the survivors or of the people, you know, from that moment on made it really different. And people at the time recognized that it was different.
You talked about the racial hatred on both sides. What about that? The Americans' perceptions of the Japanese perceptions of the Americans. Why was that so difficult?
Well, I think it of course, there's a stream. I'm no expert in Japanese history, but I am an American historian, and racism was deeply embedded in American culture. I'm told that there was a certain kind of that in Japan also over the generations, a sense of uniqueness. And Japanese had been, coming to the United States since the last quarter of the 19th century, and there were, in fact, in California, Japanese exclusion laws and racial dislike, but it was accentuated tremendously by the war. By the attack on Pearl Harbor, by the desperate nature of the fighting, the mm-hmm. the way in which the Japanese armed forces resisted the invasion of their areas they had conquered, and then the home islands, particularly Okinawa and Iwo Jima, and so it in a sense it escalated at least amongst the population and the armed forces. Through the war, mm. and it made, I think, a certain bitterness on both sides. Mm.
I want to round it out by asking you if you fear nuclear war in your lifetime.
Well, I may be special in this case. I fear it less today than I did during the Cold War, which was most of my lifetime, when the two superpowers had them aimed and targeted on each other for decades. It certainly is possible. It was less possible in the later stages of the Cold War. But I may fear it less than many people. I certainly feel if these radical Islamic terrorists get a hold of a weapon, they'll use it. But I don't know that it will be very easy for them to get such a weapon. And even if they do, the consequences will be tragic and horrifying, but nothing like what was possible during the Cold War.
Richard Cohen is professor of military history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I appreciate your time, Professor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
We're talking with Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Stephen Okazaki. His new film is White Light, Black Rain, The Destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which will begin airing on HBO next week. Stephen, you made reference to a story from your film earlier in this hour, and I want to play some of that now. Etsuko Nagano convinced her family to move to Nagasaki just weeks before the bombing. Here she is.
The boy's face was swollen. His eyes were gone. His body was completely burned. His skin was shredded and falling off. I couldn't believe it was my brother. We used a wooden door for a stretcher and looked for help. My mother tried to comfort him. My brother was fortunate because he got to hear my mother's voice before he went to heaven.
She was the only one in her family to survive.
My
My sister, Kuniko, was 13. Her gums were bleeding. All of her hair fell out. Her body was covered with purple spots. She was writhing in pain. After the bomb, she seemed fine, so we didn't understand what was happening to her. Then she died. It was me who convinced my parents that the family should be together in Nagasaki. A few months later, they were dead. My siblings never got to try chocolate and the other wonderful things of life. I truly wish I could have died instead of them. I felt so much guilt. I wanted to kill myself.
Stephen, I heard a story about the making of this film, and I hope it's right. But in the first version of the movie, you did not include some of the most graphic images, the most difficult to watch, but you were encouraged to put them in for history's sake. Is that true? Can you tell us that story?
Well, yeah. I mean, as a filmmaker, I feel my job is to reach the audience. And in the first cut that I was really happy with the film, I used some of the archival footage shot by a Japanese crew that's was quite beautifully shot in black and white. But there was a really... really brutal footage, color footage shot by the U.S. Army film crews that I, frankly, I avoided. I just sort of left on the shelf. And
because it was hard for you to watch.
The other material. It was, yeah. I mean, I think, and my excuse was I brought the first cut to HBO, and they said, this is great, but where's the really horrific footage, you know? And I said, well, you know, if we put that in, people are going to turn the channel or leave the theater. And the HBO executive, Sheila Nevins, said, you know, this may be the only time, you know, that... that we're able to tell the story, or anyone can do it with these resources, and you should not censor yourself. I mean, it was horrible. So, you know, if people have to leave the theater or turn the channel, so be it. But that does not mean we should tell the story in a polite way or not show the horror. And so it was slow going for me. I really struggled with it, then realized, well, we'll just have to make a better movie that people just keep watching and make it compelling. And I always tell people, it's okay to, you know, just close your eyes, but stay with the movie, you know, mm-hmm. if you have to.
I want to go to the phones. Stephen, callers would like to join you in this conversation. Dan is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Dan, you're on the line.
Yeah, hi. I had a remembrance of an old Japanese film called Black Rain. It was about the survivors. The disaster happened in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and then the rest of the movie is about the survivors. Also, I was curious, you know, the personal tragedies are on such a scale that, you know, these survivors watched their cities die, and basically their culture, the Japanese God King, ended, like, you know, on August 11th. It was like the culture died. I mean, I was just curious, as, you know, on that scale, whether or not the director has any insight.
Dan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Stephen, your reflections on the immensity.
The Black Rain is a dramatic film, a Japanese film. Well, you know, I think that... Japanese are, you know, pragmatic people, and the kind of amazing thing is, you know, when the war ended, they said, now we're going to devote ourselves to peace, and the emperor is not a god, he's a man. And then that day, you know, great majority of the population said okay, and so suddenly you had a culture devoted to peace, and the U.S. General MacArthur came in, and the Americans forced a constitution on Japan that said they could have no military, and the Japanese accepted that, and developed one of the world's great peace economies in a, you know, with people talk about the sort of zealousness of the Japanese during the war, and they became zealous. They developed a zealous peace economy, and so we get the Prius and the DVD players now. Mm. The ironic thing now is that the United States is pushing Japan to remilitarize, to rebuild their military, and it does seem to be headed that way. And the United States is clearly looking for a partner, as they have with Great Britain and the war in the Middle East. The United States is clearly looking for a similar kind of partner should there be problems in Asia. But, you know, the shocking thing is, I mean, on one hand, you see the devastation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and people, the woman who we heard the clip from, who lost her mother, she lived in a tiny little shack right in the middle of the devastation, and she showed me a picture of the shack, and I asked her, you know, how long did you live there, a year or 6 months? And she said, no, I lived in that shack with 12 other orphans for 10 years, and we... You know, we just figured out how to survive, and we tried to figure out what to do with grass. If you could eat it straight, make salad from it, make soup. When the GIs came, they ate out of the garbage. But it's disturbing. You know, the devastation, right. But it's truly inspiring, that desire to survive and
the courage.
Yes.
Mm. Back to the phones with Ray, who's calling from Carthage, New York. Hi, Ray, you're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm 81 years old now, and I was on Guam in 1945, and we were preparing for the invasion of Japan because they would not surrender. I was in the Seabees. We built the air bases that the bombers took off from, and I remember seeing the planes going out for months and months and months, and we were bombing them with regular bombs, but they would not surrender. And as the professor said, the fighting got fiercer and fiercer as we got closer and closer to Japan, so because they were so determined. They fought so fiercely on Iwo Jima and Okinawa that we had to go into their caves with flamethrowers to subdue them, and they would not surrender. We had 200,000 troops on Guam preparing for the invasion. Our rifles were, we had bayonets fixed on the ends of on the rifles. So when we went into the invasion, it would be hand-to-hand warfare. That's what they were preparing for. Mm. And Truman and our military estimated that we would lose 2 million men in the invasion of Japan. I would like to speak for the boys at Pearl Harbor and all the islands in the Pacific who never got to taste chocolate because of the Japanese, the destruction that they wrought on Pearl Harbor, which started the war.
Ray, I'm going to let Stephen respond to that. Thank you, sir, for your call. I appreciate it. Stephen?
Well, I appreciate hearing from him. My father, I'm Japanese-American, but my father fought in the war in against the Germans in Europe. But I think, you know, I feel, though, he's saying that, therefore, the use of an atomic weapon is okay. And I find that a little bit hard. I mean, it was a ferocious war. But I think saying, therefore, you know, we can wipe out 140,000 people in a moment. And, you know, I think this residual bitterness about World War II. It's just, I mean, I've heard these arguments over and over. And 10 years ago, ABC News and Peter Jennings analyzed, I mean, this is not to dispute what he's saying, but it's just there's a lot of speculation about the number of lives saved. And Peter Jennings did a piece for ABC News on the 50th anniversary, and they noted that the numbers actually started at 10,000 lives and just ballooned just when someone used a figure to a million lives. And then recently people are saying a million Americans might have died and 10 million Japanese might have died. Mm-hmm. But this is all speculation. And it deals with, you know, what if, and what all we're trying to do is talk about, I don't think it should be used to deny, you know, the horror of nuclear war. I think the war with Japan was absolutely horrendous, but I don't think we should use that as a reason to say, well, it's okay to use nuclear weapons then or now.
I want to hear from those who actually carried out the bombings in Hiroshima. These are their thoughts right after the explosion.
The reaction was one of almost disbelief. We really didn't think the bomb could be that powerful.
No one spoke with glee. That sort of expression was not used.
I was busy doing my things, but also I did not feel the urge to pray for anybody at that time. I probably should have. Why not? But I didn't.
In my notebook, all I wrote was, it went off. It really did. It really did.
We dropped the bomb. We dropped it on time, on target. And that's what we were trained to do and what we wanted to do. And finally, as we got to talking about it a little bit more, there's a feeling that this war was over.
You heard from navigator Theodore Van Kurt, weaponeer Morris Jepson, and scientific observers Lawrence Johnston and Harold Agnew. I guess my question for you, after hearing them and hearing our 81-year-old veteran Ray, our caller, I get the sense that, I mean, ignorance is sort of a recurring theme throughout this film. I mean, not many people know or remember what happened those 2 days in August 1945. And you start the film interviewing young people in Japan who themselves don't remember. Was this educational for you? And are you disappointed, or what are your thoughts about the lack of sort of understanding of this very important event?
Well, I think while I was making the film, it was difficult. It's very difficult material, but having finished the film, I'm actually feel much more positive. I think it's a really receptive time where the conversation doesn't need to be stopped by, you know, bitterness on both sides from World War II, that people realize that it's about, you know, tomorrow, not yesterday, and we ought to. That the story is important for what it means for tomorrow. And I think we've been so bogged down by the unresolved feelings of Americans and Japanese. I mean, the Japanese, themselves have not, I think, resolved their atrocities that they committed during World War II, and often like to take a sort of victim's position, and I don't think that's real either. But we showed the film to five high school classes in Salt Lake City a little while ago, and they were not the special students. They were just the kids who wanted to get out of class to see a movie, and they came out to a regular movie theater, and we showed them the film, and I've never been so impressed with young people. I mean, and they, I was, they responded to the film. They wanted their friends to see it. They talked about, that it was an issue that had so much to do with their lives and their futures. Not just their grandparents and great grandparents, but it was. The responsiveness and the sense of responsibility in the kids, I was really impressed with. I think that, unfortunately, though, it's very hard to reach that audience. I mean, I think it's amazing that HBO took on this film, but it's hard when you're debating, when you're up against news about Lindsay Lohan's latest escapade.
Well, Stephen Okazaki's new film is White Light, Black Rain, The Destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It begins airing next week on HBO. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
WBUR producers Meghna Chakrabarty and Hilary McQuilkin read the English translations of the Japanese survivors' stories. You can continue the conversation on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.